It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, we've got a sea chase. It's the good guys versus the bad guys, depending on whose side you're on. They're dodging icebergs along the coast of Antarctica, and it's all for a fish that was considered trash 20 years ago. It's a story of Chilean sea bass from Bruce Necht, author of Hooked: Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. Well, Food and Wine's Ray Isle has the latest shishi hoo-ha sipping liquors, the new tequilas. Fred Plotkin, the self-described pleasure activist, tours us into the deep south, as in eating and sipping our way through Santiago, Chile. I'm challenged in a new round of Stump the Cook with celebrity stuntmaster Christopher Kimball. And then we talk Marilyn Merlot and the Naked Grape, weird wines with even stranger stories. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. So you two, where have you been? What's the latest discovery?
I'll tell you exactly where we've been. 1634 West North Avenue in Milwaukee.
1634. Okay, right. I'll write that down.
A friend of ours said, if you want a really, really good corned beef sandwich, go to Jake's. It's an old, ancient deli in Milwaukee. Well, they open at 10 o'clock, and we got there at 9:50, and I think we were probably at the end of a line with maybe 23 people.
Really?
Yeah, this is absolutely an icon in Milwaukee.
And while there are a few other things on the menu, like pastrami and some wonderful matzo ball soup, it seemed to us that 90 to 95% of the business was people coming in for these absolutely magnificent corned beef sandwiches. And when I say magnificent, I mean everyone sliced by hand to order, a little fattier, a little leaner, a little thicker, a little thinner, however you like it. They do one really interesting thing there I've never seen anywhere else. Before they, you know, they take out the whole corned beef, the brisket,
right,
put it on the slicing block, and sprinkle it with a little paprika.
Oh,
I only saw this after we ate, and frankly, I didn't notice, oh boy, paprika when I ate the sandwich, but there is a kind of zest to the corned beef that maybe comes from that. The other one thing I have to mention about this corned beef sandwich is not only is the beef, you know, moist and spicy and warm and just utterly succulent, the rye bread they put it on is what you want corned beef to be on. It's got that kind of slick, slightly tough crust. I mean, it's chewy, good, chewy rye bread.
Seeded rye.
And that to me is, you know, is 50% of a great corned beef sandwich.
But, and you also must wonder, who are the mavens in Milwaukee who have, you know, scoped out this great corned beef place? Well, interestingly enough, when Michael and I were numbers 24 and 25 on the line waiting to get in, we realized that we were the only people who were not African Americans. Jake's is in the heart of a black neighborhood, and it is just, you know, the toast of the town to the people who live in this neighborhood.
I think corned beef is one of those kind of pan-ethnic foods. I mean, that, and because we went, after discovering Jake's, we looked around Milwaukee some more and realized, much to our amazement and delight, that Milwaukee, you know, we always think of it as a great place for fish fries, a great place for kind of Eastern European, ethnic, Serbian, German food. In fact, it is a great corned beef city. Jake's is not the only place. There are a couple of other delis there that serve terrific corned beef. And it's one of those foods that, you know, like a fish fry, is not just relegated to the sort of ethnic group that made it popular. It's sort of loved by all.
Are they doing their own corning of that beef? I mean, are they making
absolutely
their own?
Yes. I mean, it is beautiful, beautiful corned beef.
And speaking of beautiful, beautiful, the place is just so, you know, it's frozen in time. I mean, to walk into Jake's, you really do feel like you're back in 1935. It's this ancient lunchroom with linoleum tables, tiny little ancient worn booths that you sit in, out of order buzzers on the wall, which at some point must have summoned service. And it is just so wonderfully old-fashioned.
Do you think Milwaukee is kind of blossoming with restaurants? Without it,
well, yeah.
I don't know if it's blossoming or not, but it sure is a gold mine for those of us who like, you know, food that is of the neighborhood and of the people that are there. I mean, Milwaukee is one of those cities that when we visit, we always leave frustrated because there were so many restaurants we didn't get a chance to sample.
You know, when I think of blossoming, I always think that sort of means trendy restaurants. And I think Milwaukee has, you know, blossomed and come to full bloom many years ago, but we are just finding out about it.
I remember, I don't know the details, but at some time fairly recently, Jake's was endangered or threatened. And I think a lot of people, including important politicians, went to bat for it, you know, because it is such an important part of their culinary heritage.
I'd vote for those people.
Yes, me too.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye,
Lynn. Bye-bye, Lynn. Almost 2,000 miles from my home, sweet home. 2,000 miles from the arms that bore me. 2,000 miles from my sweet home, Milwaukee.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our e-newsletters. Now, we've got two, the Classic Weeknight Kitchen and, for a limited time, Baker's Chronicle. It's a weekly e-newsletter devoted to bakers and baker wannabes. Now, every week you get a new recipe, and as usual, both e-newsletters are free. So sign up, you know where, splendidtable.org. Well, looks like tequila is going the way of bourbon and sake. It is shouldering all the chic new drinks off of the shelves. Now, margarita tequilas have been with us for decades, but sipping tequilas, well, you probably haven't run across any of these yet. Ray Isles, senior editor of Food & Wine magazine, has been tasting the new tequilas. Ray, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So how many did you go through to come up with your picks?
It's a tough job. You know, someone has to do these things.
Yes, yes.
I went through about 30 or 40 tequilas.
Huh. Could you give us a little primer here? How is tequila made, and what's the difference between the quote-unquote new tequila and the old tequila?
Well, the tequila is actually made in a fairly straightforward way. It's the best tequila is made from agave plants, 100% blue agave.
And this is what, a cactus?
This is a cactus. It looks somewhat like a, you know, it's a low to the ground aloe like thing with a big bulb in the center and a spiny thing sticking out. It also looks like a kind of like a rough pineapple. You take that center thing, it's called a piña, and you cook it in an oven with steam. So it's almost like putting it in an autoclave or a pressure cooker. And what that does is it converts the starches to sugars. And then you mill those piñas. You take them traditionally with a giant stone wheel, but more these days and something a little more technologically advanced. And you crush them and you get all the juice out, which is full of sugar. In fact, it's almost as sweet as if you were crushing yams or sweet potatoes. And then you take that sweet liquid and you ferment it, much the way you make beer, to about a sort of 5% alcohol level. And then you take that and you distill it twice by law in Mexico. So you end up with a distilled 100% blue agave product. The, you know, less expensive or less artisanal style takes a little bit of blue agave, you know, the blue agave juice, and then mixes it with something industrial like molasses or sugarcane juice or some other sweet liquid. So it's most of the very affordable tequilas you'll see have kind of minimal agave content to them.
So you are concentrating then on the ones that are 100% agave, right?
Exactly. Those are the true sipping tequilas, and honestly, for mixing drinks too, they're just better. There's so much more intensity of flavor that you can't really beat them.
Okay, now what should we look for in a label, and what does that mean?
There are three basic types of tequila. There's Blanco tequilas, Reposado tequilas, and Añejo tequilas. And the Blanco is very straightforward. The Blanco, when you finish that distillation process, you've got a clear, you know, tequila, and you put it straight into a bottle, and that's a Blanco.
And what does it taste like? What does it taste like?
What you get is, what the agave imparts is a kind of, I mean, vegetal has a negative character, a negative connotation to it, but it is a vegetal kind of green flavor in a way, and a smokiness, and also often a kind of minty or herbal character, which is a little bit what people think of when they think of tequila, but when you taste these 100% blue agave tequilas, it's so much more refined and so much more elegant. Reposados are aged a little bit, essentially. They're aged usually in large wooden tanks for at least 2 months and up to a year. What that does is it gives a little bit of wood character to the tequila. You've still got a lot of that fresh vegetal agave character, but you've also got a little bit of vanilla sweetness. You'll get a slightly amber or light gold color and a little more richness. And then añejos have a minimum of 1 year of aging and often quite a bit more in barrels, in say, same sort of barrels you'd see wine aged in.
Right,
in fact, what they often use is used bourbon barrels from bourbon producers. And those añejos are a deeper gold. They have much more kind of vanilla, caramel, toffee flavors. But again, that underwriting agave, you know, particular agave flavor kind of floats through as a note that holds the thing together.
So I'm gathering this is not margarita tequila.
Well, actually, I think the good Blanco tequilas are, in fact, great in margaritas. Uh-huh. And actually, a quick margarita tip, if you want one, there's a very simple recipe for a great margarita. All you have to remember is 3-2-1, which is 3 parts tequila, 2 parts Cointreau, 1 part fresh lime juice.
Oh.
Mix it up on the rocks, pour it, perfect drink. And the Blancos taste wonderful in that because you really can taste the flavor of the tequila coming through. The Reposados and Añejos, personally, I think they're sipping liquors. They're like the same thing you would do with a single barrel bourbon or a really fine quality Scotch.
Has this been around in Mexico for a long time?
Well, the basic categories have been around in Mexico for a long time, but they haven't been marketed in this high end way.
Uh-huh.
Cuervo, for instance, has been making tequila in Mexico since the 1700s, or something that is the equivalent of tequila, you know, early on that wasn't really called tequila. But and a lot of the artisan producers started in the 30s and 40s. But a lot of the kind of high-end 100% blue agave, reposados and añejos are recent products that are there to follow on this market that was started by single malt scotches and moved on then to high-end rums and high-end bourbons.
Mm-hmm.
And tequilas, you know, there are hundreds of them out there at this point. It's if you go into, you know, a restaurant that focuses on tequila, like the Mesa Grill in New York or something, you'll see a wall of different
yes.
bottles of, you know, all of which cost, you know, $60 or $70 a pop.
Yeah. Hey, Ray, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ray Isle is senior editor at Food & Wine magazine. His article on the new tequilas appeared in the June 2006 issue of the magazine. Well, talking about tequila with Ray reminded me of a caller from a while back. We dubbed him Tequila Steak Steve. Now, he'd heard an interview that I'd done with a food scientist about how different substances release different flavors. One group of flavors opens up in fats, another group in water, but both those groups, plus a whole flock of other flavors, are released by alcohol. Well, Steve was no dummy. He got the logic. So before grilling, he immersed his steak in a bottle of tequila. He said it was the best steak that he ever had. Of course, all I could think of was one spark from that grill hitting that tequila, and Steve and his steak would literally be toast. Definitely too much of a good thing. But adaptation is everything, and thanks to Steve, I fooled around with Tabasco tequila steak, with full credit to the man who inspired it. Now, you can find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Chilean sea bass, the fish-inspiring pirates and poachers, hanging out in Santiago, and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. If you were in Australia in August of 2003, you'd have found a country glued to headlines. For 3 weeks, Australia's front pages were filled with a sea chase, perhaps the longest in maritime history. An Australian government ship was chasing an outlaw ship in the world's most dangerous waters, 4,000 miles around the continent of Antarctica. Now, here's the curious part. The reason for the chase was a fish nobody in Australia ate, but one that has a multi-million dollar market in the United States. Yet we never heard a word about this saga. Not until Bruce Necht wrote Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. Bruce, welcome.
It's good to be here.
So, 4,000-mile chase. What's the story here?
Well, the chase began. It was August of 2003, and it was near Heard Island, which is halfway between the west coast of Australia and South Africa, and a few hundred miles north of Antarctica, which is to say pretty much near nothing.
Right.
But it happens to be one of the greatest population of the Patagonia toothfish that lives in the waters surrounding Heard Island. Patagonia toothfish in our country, here's the news, as many people listening no doubt know, is Chilean sea bass to American consumers. And the island is owned by Australia, and Australia, like many countries, claims 200 miles of exclusive fishing rights around its territory. So when the Australian patrol boat spotted actually three vessels just very near to Heard Island, it had a pretty good idea what they were doing. They were fishing, no doubt, for what we call Chilean sea bass. The Australians gave chase. The fishing vessel fled to the south towards Antarctica. When it hit sort of the ice, it kind of took a right turn, and it kept on going.
And they kept trying to contact the vessel. They actually were talking to the vessel, but the vessel was ignoring all of their demands, right?
It was doing nothing but running at high speed, which, of course, is a pretty dangerous thing to do when you're going through water that is, you know, strewn with icebergs. At one point, they turned on the radar, and they had 72 icebergs within 24 miles, you know, which is bad enough in daylight and good weather. But they were going through difficult waves, through fog, through this is the winter in the southern hemisphere, snow. And, of course, icebergs are not always visible. Sometimes they have projections that go underwater and growlers, bodies of ice that are just a foot or two above the surface of the water. You don't see that on radar. So it's a really treacherous game.
Now, wait a minute. This is all because of the Chilean sea bass? I mean, is this worth this kind of danger?
Well, Chilean sea bass went from being a fish that nobody ever heard of to becoming what is sometimes called a delicacy. And, you know, I'm in New York today where I saw it in the market for $32 a pound a couple days ago. So the vessel that ran, it eventually identified itself as the Viarsa, Spanish-owned vessel. It could fill its hold with 300 tons of fish in the space of 2 or 3 months. Now, that amount of fish, that's fish with the heads and the tails and the guts taken off, is worth $3.5 million. Now, the Viarsa, the vessel, if we were to go out and buy it, we could get it for about $1.5 million. So it tells you, you know, you could, on the basis of 1, 2, or 3 month expedition, you can pay for the vessel and have an enormous profit. And then, of course, you go, it just goes on from there. At a time when fishing is a pretty marginal business in most parts of the world for most species, you know, we constantly reading about fishermen going out of, you know, and stopping because there's no more fish.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a fish that is so lucrative the economics begin to resemble the illegal drug trade, and some fishermen call it, in fact, white gold.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing here that's interesting that you made a point of in the book is the point of view of the people on that boat. The master of that boat saw this, that what he was doing, there was nothing wrong with it. And that was what I found so interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was very important to tell their side of the story. You know, they're Spanish. The Spanish are the best fishermen the world has ever seen, and not all of them operate illegally, so many of them operate legitimately, of course. But Antonio Perez, the fishing master, I got to know quite well, and he doesn't see himself as the bad guy. He thinks this 200-mile exclusive right to fish around an island is more about protecting domestic fishermen who aren't as good as he is than protecting interesting fish. And his point of view is, as he expressed it to me many times, don't worry about this fish. If this fish becomes, you know, scarce, there'll always be another species. But one of the things that I concluded in researching the book is it's not true. It has been true for hundreds of years. But we're at the end of the line. This is the last big fin fish we are going to find in the ocean anywhere. Because what people don't really realize is that the oceans seem vast, but fish don't live everywhere in the ocean. They live in water that's relatively shallow, the water near islands and continental shelves. The vast preponderance of the ocean is strangely enough, a desert. So this is a fish that fishermen have to go literally to the bottom of the world to find. There's not going to be another one.
Well, something else to think about when you're sitting in a restaurant ordering dinner. Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Bruce Necht is author of Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. Cookbook author and pleasure activist Fred Plotkin was born to travel. Now, he's never the tourist. He's always the independent explorer. Fred has a hedonist instinct for the local food and a scholar's antenna for what makes a city tick. Fred takes us, well, beyond the guidebooks. Fred, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, you've just been to Chile, right?
Yes.
What is Santiago like?
Well, Santiago de Chile, the capital of Chile, is the capital of this very long, thin country that's about 2,500 miles up and down the Pacific Ocean on one side.
Wow.
And the Andes Mountains in the other. And at the top of the country is the Atacama Desert, and at the bottom of the country is the Tierra del Fuego and fjords. So you have this amazing environment in a country that's often, at some point, just 20 miles wide. So therefore, when you open a map of Chile, unlike, say, Colorado, which is square,
right,
it's like opening a centerfold, and it keeps coming out and coming out and coming out and coming out. And you see that your left hand is in the desert and your right hand is all the way down in the fjords. In the middle of the country is Santiago. And Santiago is in a big valley called the Maipo Valley. And this is one of the most fertile areas of South America, if not the world. And I think that the people who originally settled there, the Spaniards, noted how incredibly rich it was in land, and they just started planting. And there are rivers that run through it and mountain streams that furnish water and Pacific breezes. And anything you plant grows there. And as we all know, Chile has a famous wine industry. So just outside the capital are miles and miles and miles of beautiful vineyards, all planted with many different varieties of mostly European grapes.
So what does the city look like? Is it Spanish colonial? Is it very modern?
The city is somewhat modern, somewhat Spanish colonial, somewhat low-slung buildings of South America. It has a very nice Ritz-Carlton hotel with an excellent restaurant.
Uh-huh.
It has beautiful modern 1970s, 1980s buildings. Don't forget, Chile has had a very rocky history. It's a very stable country now,
mm-hmm,
but it was a socialist country for a while, and then Pinochet took over in Salvador. Allende was thrown out. And most Chileans I know, and my next-door neighbor is Chilean, walk around with a certain sadness because either they were of the right or of the left, and they can never reconcile that the country finally now seems to be forming a united country, which I think is terrific. They carry these old feelings with them. So the Chileans, or the people of Santiago especially, are a little sad, a little reserved, but also among the most courteous people I've ever encountered anywhere in the world. And to me, the great pleasure of being in Santiago is interaction on the streets, because the people are lovely.
When it comes to the food, and well, now you mentioned the wine, what are the standouts for you?
Well, when you have 2,500 miles of ocean and not much of a population, it means that there's all this water teeming with fish ready to be eaten. So every day in the Mercado Central, the central market of Santiago, there's a fantastic display of what's ever come out of the water, whether it's Pacific tuna, many local fishes that I've never seen elsewhere, mm-hmm. and the cangrejo, the king crab, that is just gorgeous because it's big and spiny and threatening looking, but then it has the most delicious fresh crab taste in it. And it's eaten many different ways. My favorite way is called pastel de cangrejo, which comes in a ramekin, and it's basically baked crab with a little bit of cheese. But scallops are great. Everything I had in the Central Market in terms of food is great. By the way, the Central Market is full of restaurants, so you can wander from one to the next, sampling a dish here, a dish there, and terrific. Really genuine, not for tourists, but just for local people.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you'd suggest we go to eat.
I would hang out there day and night, and then go for wine tastings at the Ritz-Carlton. They always have an open bar, and the latest wines that come in are done there, and it's a very nice place to meet people who care about wine.
You know, I'm thinking we see Chilean wines here, and they're generally on the inexpensive side, and they can be very fine. Are there wines there that we would never see, things that are particularly precious?
There's a grape that is only coming into its own now, and it has a way to go called Carmenere. And when grapes were first shipped to Chile a long time ago, mostly from France, in crates that were labeled Merlot, there were also Carmenere grapes, and they looked enough alike as grapes, and nobody really paid attention to the fact that as they matured, the leaves of one were red and the leaves of the other were yellow. And I believe that the Merlot leaves were yellow and the Carmenere were red.
Mm-hmm.
And they just blended the grapes together and called it Merlot. Now, one grape matures faster than the other, so they're now separating Carmenere and working with it on its own. And I believe that in a few more years, when they figured out its strengths and its weaknesses, they're going to produce a wonderful mid-weight wine that will rival Merlot.
Hmm. This is something to look forward to. Fred, thank you.
Thank you.
Food writer and culinary historian Fred Plotkin writes for national publications, and he's author of the newly updated Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. It's time to play Stump the Cook, our refrigerator game, and we have our very strict judge, our guest celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball, of Cook's Illustrated Magazine fame, and he is host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. Well, Chris, you going to be lenient today?
I'm in a hanging mood, so watch out, Lynn. It better be good. It's going to be tough.
Explain the rules, because then people will know how deeply challenged I am going to be.
There are three simple rules. There are five things in our guest's refrigerator you can use, have to use, I should say. You get a free pass on water, salt and pepper, and oil. Plus, you can use up to three other ingredients that happen to be in our guest's kitchen, and you have to make one dish out of this that I deem to be not only edible, but actually something I'd want to eat.
And I've never heard of this person before or their refrigerator.
Well, we have on the line Kathleen from Chicago. Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Hi there.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hello.
What's in that fridge? What are your five things?
Well, not much. I have some egg substitute.
Egg sub, okay.
Some wheat bread.
All right.
About a half jar of roasted red peppers.
Uh-huh.
Some white onions. And some Irish cheddar.
Oh.
This is Omelet territory.
Is that Dublin cheddar?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Boy, I like that. It's like eating butter. It's so luscious.
Yes,
isn't it
good so
stuff?
Good.
You know what I feel coming on here? I feel kind of a take on a savory French toast.
Oh, okay.
Ooh, that's
you
interesting.
Know?
I thought you were headed towards a frittata or something.
No, well, it could be, but you know, I'm thinking of the wheat bread. You could do a baked version of the French toast, or you could do a skillet version. If you want to do a baked version, I have a scathingly brilliant idea, Kathleen.
Okay.
This.
If she says so herself.
If I do say so myself, in all modesty. Right. This could be something that you could serve as like a main dish with just a salad. Okay, this is what you want. You want to sauté the onions in a little bit of olive oil.
Okay.
You want to break up the bread into nice-sized chunks and put it into a slow oven so it gets really dry.
It's so many words, you're trying to make it stale.
Okay.
And you need about a 2-quart baking dish. Have you got a fair amount of egg substitute there?
It's about a half. Yeah, I think there's about 4 to 6 eggs.
All right, we're going to make a small version of this. Okay.
Okay,
so you want maybe 4 slices of bread that you break up into chunks, and you want something like an 8x8 square baking dish or baking pan, all right?
Okay.
And you want to sauté those onions, and you want to sauté them in a little bit of olive oil with a lot of fresh basil. Do you have fresh basil?
I do.
I knew it. Nobody would call this show that does not have fresh basil in their refrigerator. Okay, salt and pepper.
Someone with egg substitutes has fresh basil? That's good.
Right? No, but hey, egg substitute is egg. It's real stuff. It's really good stuff.
It's all egg white and food coloring. Anyway, go ahead.
He's very acerbic at times.
I know.
He's just terrible. Now, the other thing we need is some milk or cream in here.
I have milk. It's skim milk.
All right. We're going to make this really lean. What we're going to do is, with the egg substitute and the milk, we're going to make a custard. Okay, so you want about 1/2 cup of milk to start with. You're going to beat the egg substitute with the milk with more fresh basil, salt and pepper, and some of the shredded Irish cheddar.
Oh, all right.
Okay, and then what you're going to do is you're going to spread the bread in the bottom of this pan that you buttered or greased in some way, my little square baking pan, so that's just about full of bread, and you're going to sprinkle the roasted red peppers on it and all of that onion that you've sautéed.
Oh.
Okay, and you're going to pour the egg into that, the egg custard, and top it with even more shredded Irish cheddar.
Not a problem. Okay.
Right? Okay, you got me? And you're going to cover it, put it in the fridge overnight, and then the next day, let it come up to room temperature. You're going to bake it in a 325-degree oven for about 40 to 45 minutes until, when you stick a knife into the edge, you know, close to the edge, it comes out clean.
And
when you pull it out of the oven, let it sit about 10 minutes. It'll finish the cooking process. And what you'll get is, they used to call them stratas. They're called baked omelets. But it's really a delicious thing. You can just cut it into squares, and it has all that fresh basil in it. That fresh herb is going to just be fabulous with the browned onion and the cheddar. And you've cooked it covered, so the cheddar's not going to get, you know, leathery and brown. And it's fabulous with a green salad.
Oh, it's
wonderful.
You know,
Lynn, ever
since
you stopped selling used cars, you've really done a great job in the food world. My mouth's watering. Well, I have to say, you can't go wrong with cheese, eggs, and bread. But you're a winner. Again, Lynn is a winner.
I am so pleased.
Now, the strata was brilliant.
Thank you.
Yes, it was.
Kathleen, thanks so much for playing.
Thank you.
And Chris, I can't believe how kind you're being. Thank you.
I was a hanging judge today, but that was good.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Kathleen.
Our guest celebrity stump master is Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cooks Illustrated magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, if you want to challenge me and Stump the Cook, you give us a call, 800-537-5252, and one of our canny producers may call you to be on the air. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge, and the question is, who made the first tequila? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can call us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, who made the first tequila? Well, it was the Spanish invaders of Mexico. They found the Aztecs sipping a drink called pulque, and I may have mispronounced that. It was made from the agave plant. And now you have to know that the agave for the Aztecs was nearly sacred. They got everything from the plant: clothing, rope, food, and of course, pulque. Well, those culturally sensitive Spanish conquistadores could have cared less. What they did care about was that pulque tasted awful to their European palates. Now, since grapes didn't exist and no one had told them how corn could become bourbon, they were stuck with the agave plant. So they needed some Eurotech here. They distilled the fermented juice of the agave, and they made mezcal, which is sort of a rougher, tougher version of tequila. Actual tequila evolved in the area where the agave's at its best, the Jalisco region. Now, all of this comes from a little book called Alcoholica Esoterica by Ian Lendler. Now, he claims tequila became popular in Mexico during the Mexican Revolution in 1910. You see, Jalisco was a major battlefield. It came to North America with the 1950s fad of exotic cocktails, tequila all covered up in sugar and lime, as in the margarita. And now at last, we have got the superfine sipping tequilas. A long trip.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
It's time for your calls, brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Pick up that phone, guys. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Let's see now. We have Jim calling from Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Jim, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about green lemons.
Green, as in limes?
Well, these are actually ponderosa lemons that only 6 months old.
Oh.
And what I did, like most of us who move here from up north and buy a house, I immediately planted citrus. And I planted 6 citrus trees along my back wall on a trellis, so I espaliate them.
Right, right.
And it was a wonderful effect, and everything was just so great until I got really lazy and stopped pruning them. And, of course, the ponderosa lemon decided to grow right out and right over my grills. I couldn't see my grills until I took drastic action, and I cut 2 branches off. Now I dragged them in through the house onto the front yard, and I immediately picked all of these lemons off. Now, as you probably, I'm sure you know, that these ponderosa lemons get to be the size of a grapefruit.
Yeah, so, they're pretty big. There's a reason why they call them the ponderosa. I mean, this is a huge lemon.
Well, anyway, I picked them off, and they look exactly like Persian lime. So they're the same size as a Persian lime.
Oh,
I also have a Mexican lime that's just loaded, too. So here I am with this fruit. I've got 3 buckets full off of just 2 branches. And what do I do with it?
How does it taste? Have you squeezed
it? Well, you know, oddly enough, it sat around in these buckets for several days, and they actually look what I always call Mexican limes when they're green with yellow spots or, you know, blotches on them.
Yeah.
And then I call them key limes where they're completely ripe. Well, at this point, they now look like Mexican limes. And actually, I made a margarita a couple of nights ago and used it, and it was pretty good. But I don't.
So
I
you're
can't
saying,
drink
what do
many.
I do with 2 buckets of lemons that look like they ate the city of Phoenix?
That's happening all over the valley.
That's happening all over the valley, and no, you can't give them away to anybody because everybody else has them. It's like zucchini in
August.
Yeah,
and this is a double whammy because they don't know what to do with them.
Oh, boy. Okay, let's see now. Well, first of all, the first thing that comes to mind is make Moroccan preserved lemons, but you can't do two buckets worth. Moroccan preserved lemons. Preserved lemons are where you make slashes into the side of the lemon, and you put it in sterilized jars, mm-hmm. whole lemons. You're going to need big jars. And the idea is you pack them in salt and lemon juice, and you leave them sit for a minimum of 3 weeks, and that salt cures into the lemon. And when you flavor salads with slivers of that lemon, you cook it into wonderfully spicy, aromatic dishes, you know, stews and that kind of thing. And it has a fabulous flavor. But that'll take care of maybe, you know, and you can give them at Christmas. So let's say you've taken care of maybe 8 or 9 of your lemons. But I think the other thing you might want to do here is, because they're going to have, I think they're going to have a really interesting taste. Because if I remember correctly, quite a while ago, I was doing a lot of research into the Renaissance in Italy. And one of the ingredients you ran into all the time was citron. And, you know, citron was this big, it looked like a lemon with knobs on it. And it has a spicy, sour taste. Well, from what I remember, because I was looking for a source for citron in the United States to test with, and I found out that Ponderosa is a cross between a lemon and a citron. Mm-hmm. So I think you're going to get a nice spicy flavor from these babies. So what I would do is I would take the rind, first of all. You can candy it. It would be fabulous, just like candied citron or candied orange rind or lemon rind. And then you can dip that in chocolate, and you have a candy that you will just die for.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, now, I do make limoncello.
Okay, well, use this to do the limoncello. I think it would be fabulous. The other thing is you can squeeze the juice and freeze it, and then you can have it for the entire year. And you need to do lemon curd, do lemon cream, do lemon pie, do lemon meringue pie. It's work, but it's going to be fabulous because you'll have this fabulous tasting juice. But I would take the rind, which, if I remember, isn't it fairly thick?
Yes.
Yeah, because that was the thing that with citrons, citrons are almost all rind. And you can look it up in cookbooks, but the process of candying the rind is that you keep putting it into new batches of sugar syrup and cooking it and then draining it and letting it dry a bit and then cooking it again and again until the sugar syrup entirely permeates that rind, but you still get that lemony, spicy, tart flavor. And that, you can do it in thick pieces, you can do it in very thin slices, and then that can flavor other things or be served on its own. You put that next to a pile of sweet potatoes on Thanksgiving, and it is fabulous. Some slices of that candied rind, your home candied rind, it'd be fabulous. And of course, as I said, dip it in chocolate. But my mouth is watering now at the thought.
Yeah, and me too.
And your kitchen will smell like nothing on earth.
Well, how would you like to have a bucket of unripe Ponderosa?
Ship away. I would love it. When I finally got my hands on real citron, I went nuts, and I was doing this kind of thing because it had that spiciness, and I think some of that exists in the Ponderosa. But one way or the other, just lemons this good and this fresh, you're going to get a product that's absolutely fabulous.
I'm going to go and do it.
Okay. All right. And you'll let us know how it works?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
give us a call and let us know.
Very good. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. I want my own Ponderosa tree. That sounds great, but that sounds like a large harvest. Anyway, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Anil on the line from New York City. Anil, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about the need to devein shrimp before we do anything with it.
Uh-huh.
I've read a cookbook somewhere, and I was trying to trace it last night but couldn't find it, where I think this is a guy who runs a restaurant in London who says that there's no need to devein shrimp. And the other thing I was thinking of is when you throw shrimp on what the Australians call the barbie,
right.
And you throw it on with the shells and all,
you don't devein it.
That's
right. Well, I have to tell you, though, there are some fanatics who cut through the shell on the back of the shrimp and devein it. You know, this is my theory. the only time I devein shrimp is when they're really big and there's a chance that that vein's going to be sandy or taste ugly. And you know, that's the only, and then it's easy because, you know, maybe it's 5 to the pound. So it's a very simple thing to devein 6 or 7 shrimp, maybe at the most.
Right.
It's not a lot of work. I don't devein my smaller shrimp. It's a pain in the neck.
It is. It's an absolute pain. And I was just concerned, are there any health reasons for not deveining them?
I have a feeling we'll get a ton of emails of people saying, do you know that that's the digestive tract and, you know, whatever the shrimp aid will be in there. Well, whatever the shrimp aid is going to be. It's going to be in the shrimp.
Shrimp, yeah.
So one way or the other.
I've stopped deveining shrimp for some time now.
And you haven't died yet.
I haven't died yet.
And they taste good, right?
Yeah, they taste great.
This is basically my theory as well.
Oh, I'm delighted that I'm not the only one who does it.
Know that there's somebody else marching right beside you holding the banner saying, forget deveining shrimp.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. And thank you, because I have a feeling you've clarified something for a lot of people out there.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you for a great question.
Okay.
Take care. It's true. Don't worry about the veins, really, unless they're really huge shrimp, okay? There are so many things like that. Like, you don't have to rub each mushroom with a towel, guys. If you drop them in a sink full of water, swish them around real fast, get that dirt off, and get them out fast, and press them dry in paper towels, it's done. Fiddling with food, I believe in it, but don't get carried away. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Call me oversensitized to market strategies, but I feel like wines with quirky names are swarming the shelves. Big House Red, which is made outside of a prison, Fat Bastard, Mad Housewife. Well, British wine enthusiast Peter May started tracking these creatures. His book is Marilyn Merlot and the Naked Grape, Odd Wines from Around the World. Peter, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
So how do you feel about these wines? I mean, are these just names to cover up less than wonderful bits of liquid?
No, you can't fool the public for long. It's just a bit of fun. There's room for all sorts of wines on the market. And it's a very crowded market. You see that yourself any time you go in the supermarket or the wine shop. You bring a new wine onto the market, what name are you going to use?
It's true. Chateau Mouton Rothschild is sort of over. I mean, that kind of name probably is no longer attracting people. So.
Yeah, you'd have a bit of a problem if you labeled your wine with that name. They're pretty sharp on that. But that sort of name gives a certain image. It gives a staid, long, historic image of a wine, which is exactly what they want for Mouton Rothschild. Maybe a winery might pick a name like that on an old-fashioned label to try and get over the same sort of image.
But then we have the contrast. One of the wines in the book, Cat's Pee on a Gooseberry Bush.
Oh, that's incredibly popular.
And I'm looking at the label, and it actually is a cat looking over its shoulder, and there's a stamp that says, helping the SPCA to provide creature comforts. Somebody has a great sense of humor here.
Oh, they have. They have. But like the old saying goes, it does exactly what it says on the label. It's a classic indicator. Cat's pee on a gooseberry bush is a classic indicator of Sauvignon Blanc. And Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand has a really grassy, green, gooseberry flavor. And also, it's got like a tang. And I've not actually drunk it myself, but it's got a tang that reminds you of cat's pee.
So there's some fact here. I understand that the U.S. government had a problem with the name, that the label does not read quite the same way when it comes into the United States.
Yes. Yeah.
The United States is
a bit different to many other countries in that wineries have to submit their label for pre-approval from the government authority. Most other countries, you can stick a label on the wine and you get into trouble if there's something wrong on it.
Uh-huh.
They wouldn't accept the word P-double-E on the label. And for the U.S., it had to be changed to P-H-E-E.
Cat's fee.
Yes.
On a gooseberry bush. Okay.
Yes.
All right. There's a lot of sexual stuff on these labels, too.
Yeah, and do you know what? When the book went through the publisher, every single person in the publisher read through the book, and the message I got back from the editor was, the women here in the building think there are too many cheesecake labels there, and they would like to see a bit of beefcake. What can you do? Well, there's a label called Rude Boy, which satisfied them.
Tell us about this label.
Well, Rude Boy takes advantage of new technology in labels. It uses a heat-sensitive label, and there's a picture of a torso of a very hunky young man on the label wearing a pair of shorts. Now, it's a white wine, and white wines have to be chilled. How do you know when the temperature is correct for serving of your white wine? Well, they use a heat-sensitive label, stick Rude Boy in the fridge, and when the temperature reaches the right level of coolness, his shorts sort of vanish. He's ready for action.
And you don't want to have young people at the table when you serve it.
No, well, exactly. There's wines for all sorts, but for hen parties and, you know, ladies like to get together and chat, and one takes out this wine and they have a hoot.
X-rated wines. I love it. Peter, thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for speaking.
Wine enthusiast Peter May is the author of Marilyn Merlot and the Naked Grape, Odd Wines from Around the World. Well, that's the show this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought. One tequila, two tequila, three tequila, floor. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletters. Weeknight Kitchen is our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek, and Baker's Chronicle will get you baking over the weekend. You can also download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. Sign up for everything right there, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is supported by the Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection, gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. You can learn more at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Organic Soups. Created to savor. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Donath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.